Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is March 22nd. And the first order of business is to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner. I see she's just joining now. Bierman.
Bierman, present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Thanks. I'm going to give the 10-second notice to House Information. 10.
Morrison. Munson. Munson.
Good afternoon. I will call to order this remote hearing of the
Prior.
House Committee.
Prior, present.
Quam.
Present.
Quam, present. Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Schultz.
Schultz, present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
Quam is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. I see that Representative Munson is here. And so we'll mark you present, Representative Munson. And so just so the public understands, this is the time of year when members are often multitasking. They might be on two different Zoom committees at once. So we'll just all need to really pay attention. And we understand if someone isn't there when we call a vote or something like that. It's just that time of year. Also, because we have a very long agenda today, we have a lot of people with us on the Zoom. I would just ask, if you're not speaking to a particular bill, please keep your camera off and stay muted. And members know to stay muted unless they are called on to speak, just to make it easier for everyone. So members, there are no minutes today. We'll take those up on Friday. They didn't really get in time for us to review them. So just for simplicity here, we'll hold off on that. So we're going to go right into our agenda today, which, as I say, is quite lengthy, and we are scheduled up until 6 o'clock. So I'm really hoping we're not going to be here till 6 o'clock. We will try to take a break in the middle so that we don't end up with 3 hours solid on a Zoom. Especially that could be a little tough for the staff who can't just walk away. So first up then is House File 3368, Representative Moran. And Representative Moran, this bill is welcome to the committee, first of all. And the chair will move that House File 3368 be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance Committee. So members, we have the bill before us. The intention here is to amend the bill, amend the funding source of the bill, and then send it to the Public Safety Committee so that it can be considered there. But because it is here and because it's an important bill, I thought we should hear a little bit about the bill, and we appreciate Representative Moran bringing it. So Representative Moran, there is this author's amendment to change the funding source. Should we take that up right now?
Yes, Chair Liebling.
All right, thank you. So the chair will move the A2 author's amendment, which, as I noted, changes the funding source to move the bill to public safety. So all in favor of adoption of the A2 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Moran, to your bill as amended.
Yes, well, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to introduce House File 3368 in your committee. So, Madam Chair and members, as we all know, the last 2 years have been really tough with the pandemic, the murder of George Floyd, the civic unrest, virtual learning, isolation, loss of jobs, lack of housing, depression, stress, trauma, adverse childhood experiences, PTSD, mental health, short tempers, gun violence, inequities, and yes, racism present in our lives today have all impacted our young people and families in very negative ways and have left the urban core vulnerable to even more violence. Gun violence is a public health crisis, and it also is a public safety initiative. So House File 3368, which is Gun Down's Love Up, is an organization with the mission of promoting love, peace, and community collectiveness to end gun violence in the Twin Cities. The organization program addresses youth and community violence, focusing on prevention, intervention, and restorative practices within the African-American community. Its efforts focus on decreasing gun violence via increasing positive community interactions, conversations, spaces, and events, and creating programming to heal and prevent future retaliation. Gun violence, again, is a public safety issue, along with a public health crisis. So before us, Madam Chair, I do have a testifier, Raisha Williams, who can tell us a little bit more about her organization and the work that they do.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Moran, and thank you, Ms. Williams. Sorry, we have this weird procedure we do here. It's so awkward, but welcome to the committee and just introduce yourself, as I think you were just about to do, and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you so much, and thank you, Representative Moran. My name is Raisha Williams, and I'm the co-executive director of Guns Down Love Up. In 2018, my brother was murdered in the front of my mother's home in North Minneapolis as he was on his way to work. I was the individual who saw him there and saw him take his last few breaths. And because of that traumatic experience, it rallied myself and my family to get more involved with gun violence in the community, which has doubled over the last 2 years. Guns Down Love Up, as Representative Marina Moran mentioned, we are an organization that is community-based, and it's led by community organizers, community volunteers, and just the community at large. People have really taken to our organization because they trust us and they trust our voice. They know that we're in the community and we're invested in change for the community. Gun violence has taken the African-American community and communities around the nation by storm, but particularly here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. We have some of the highest records in gun violence, and it's affecting, and it's affecting us tremendously. We are asking today for you to support our bill so that we can expand our services, our services and build capacity. Currently, as I mentioned, we're a nonprofit organization that is ran by a small group of members who are dedicated volunteers to do this work. But as you know, it takes money, time, and resources. And over the last 3 years, we've really done a great job of building capacity, but now we need to grow stronger in our services and our programs. And so this funding will help us establish ourselves as a strong organization in the community to be able to do programs servicing community members outside of just events and healing circles of mental health programming and services, but moving into the school system and really building and expanding on our current marketing plan of ending gun violence in the Twin Cities. Thank you so much for hearing me out. I appreciate your time and your commitment and work to Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Ms. Williams. And gotta get you a glass of water.
I know we're short, so I didn't want to walk away.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for your testimony and for being here. And thank you for your good work.
Thank you.
It's so important. Are there any questions or discussion for members? Okay, Representative Grenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, question is for Representative Rena. Hey, Rena, I know we're both concerned about this issue. Does this organization, do they do anything about the organizations like the Minnesota Freedom Fund, where they post bail and put the criminals right back out on the street, right, shortly after they're arrested. I think that that's something they should address also, because if criminals know they can be right back out on the street after committing a crime.
Representative Gernhagen, you're off on another bill. Let's let Representative Moran answer whether that's part of this, because I think the answer is going to be no. And then we don't need to discuss an issue that's not before the committee. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I'm going to say that this is really a bill that's going to, is focusing on healing, and it's focusing on prevention and intervention. But to talk a little bit more, I would, Madam Chair, if it's okay, have Ms. Williams respond to Gruhagen, Representative Gruhagen's question.
All right, Ms. Williams.
Thank you. That's a great question. So we, as Marina Moran mentioned, we work with prevention, and part of that prevention programming is working with individuals who have had prior gun violence and getting them to stop, think about the effects, cause and effects of their action, so that they will then not go and perpetrate another crime and gun violence. Quite a few of our volunteers are reincarcerated individuals who did gun violence against the community. And part of their restorative practices and healing and giving back to the community is to do this work so they can prevent another youth from going down that wrong track of doing gun violence in the community and creating further harm. So we don't work directly with the organization that you mentioned, but we do work with individuals who have had prior gun violence. And part of the work is for them to come back into the community and do a restorative practice of making sure that it doesn't happen again, and they do right but they're wrong.
All right, Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam.
Okay, Representative Gernhagen, do you have a follow-up that's on the topic of the bill?
Just say she thought it was a great question, so I don't see why it was out of bounds. I just wanted to see the scope of what they were doing as far as the gun violence was concerned. And she gave a very good answer about that. So
the question was fine. It was the speech that went with it that was out of bounds. But Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will be brief, and I don't have a question so much as a comment. I just wanted to take a second to thank Chair Moran and Ms. Williams for your work and for sharing your story. And, you know, we know that gun violence is absolutely a public health crisis. And so there's no one thing that will solve the entire issue, but this certainly seems like a piece of the puzzle. And so thank you for your work and for bringing this before us today.
All right. Thank you. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question to the testifier. Ms. Williams, thank you for testifying today. And I'm wondering, how long has this organization been operating? And can you tell me about how many people you've served so far?
Absolutely. We've been operating.
Ms. Williams, sorry. Go ahead.
I apologize. I'm new to the system and the process.
Oh, it's all right. Everybody has the same issue. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, great question. So we've been in operations for 3 years. The last 2 years, we've been operating as a 501c3 organization. And the first year, we operated under our fiscal agency. We have helped directly and impacted about 10,000 people from surveys. Our organization has hosted over 300 community events that are outreach events, from healing circles, community conversations. We've had town hall meetings with local government officials. We've also done Stop the Violence rallies and community outreach. We do an event called The Takeover, where we go to a block or neighborhood that has a large high rate of violence and gun violence, and we take it over for the day and just work with community to bring love and peace and harmony to that community for the day, and ask them to support us as we go about our work to spread the message against gun violence.
Thank you. Representative Ackland.
Thank you. And I think that's all for now. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Representative Moran, final word.
Madam Chair and members, I just want to, again, thank you for the opportunity to present this bill. We know that there's lots of work to do, and it begins and starts from the ground up with those who've been impacted by the system to come back and be a part of the solution in creating street system healthy families and healthy communities. And this is what Guns Down Love Up is doing in a very positive way. Just want to again say thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Moran, and thank you, Ms. Williams, for your testimony and your work. So with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3368, as amended, be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance Committee. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would take the roll, please, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
No.
Damuth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, no.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison. Morrison. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam. Representative Quam. I think you said no, but it's really quiet. Can you repeat that?
No.
Quam,
I think
no.
I heard a no.
Yeah. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 10 ayes and 8 nays.
All right. There being 10 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to public safety. Okay, next on the agenda is House File 4387. Representative Gomez is here with us. And so the chair will move that House File 4387 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And there is an author's amendment, the A3. And I think that Representative Gomez will want to move that right now. Is that correct, Representative Gomez? And get the bill in the right shape?
Yes, please.
Okay, so the chair will move the A3 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. So all in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Gomez, to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, everybody. Good to see you all today. Unfortunately, so House File 4387 probably would have been at home during the kind of medical cannabis conversations that I know this committee has had recently. So this is sort of a straggler. As you, I'm sure, are aware, in 2014, we created a statutory duopoly through the what is widely considered the most restrictive medical cannabis policy in the country. And so this resulted in issues around, you know, high prices of products, especially when compared to the illicit market, potentially pushing people out of the program and into much less expensive, but unfortunately illegal means of acquiring their medicine. A lot of folks who live in greater Minnesota particularly have long ways to drive to access their medicine. And so, you know, this committee has undertaken, I think, along with the Office of Medical Cannabis and MDH, has really undertaken, you know, the work of addressing some of these issues. So, you know, we have added conditions for which registration is permissible. We added raw cannabis or flower to the program last year. I know that you all heard a bill earlier this year that would lower the patient registration fees. But what this bill does is it breaks up the duopoly that we have established in law. Specifically, it raises the number of companies that the Office of Medical Cannabis has to register to at least 4 and up to 10, kind of at their discretion. It kind of going through it. So the amendment adds a labor peace language. It creates factors for consideration of which companies to register when we do move into adding companies to this program. Some of those criteria, which are in the bill, are inclusion of BIPOC communities, of women, individuals with disability, or military veterans in leadership or beneficial ownership of the firms. They give extra consideration to those who can expand the service into underserved markets, gives points to those companies that have beneficial ownership by Minnesota residents, and promotes the development of greater access in low-income areas. Kind of gives Commissioner a couple of little expanded powers also. So I think that the restrictive nature of the medical cannabis market has always been of concern. But in the last 6 months, both of the original companies that were allowed in statute have sold to two of the top biggest multi-state corporate cannabis operators in the country. These were hundreds of millions of dollars of sales. And patients, unfortunately, some of them are still having trouble accessing their medication, still having to drive, long ways to get access. The patient count, because of the addition of flower, which is just kind of getting online in the last month or so, is expected to double in the next 12 months. And so instead of having these two giant conglomerate out-of-state corporations getting all of that business, we really want to expand this so that maybe some of our local operators and maybe some of our local businesses have a fighting chance in this market. This really does, it'll increase competition. We're hoping that it will bring prices down because, in this market that we have right now, unfortunately, we've had a race to the bottom where one company is raising their price to meet what the other company is charging instead of, kind of a more competitive marketplace driving prices down. That's the bill. And, I was talking to the chair about this and I was like, Chair Liebling, like, it's not the exact right thing. And like, I want to do something that's much more accessible to people, because these are big vertically integrated companies. So the barrier to entry in terms of like upfront capital investment is very high. And so what we would really like to do ultimately is kind of break this down further so that small firms really stand a chance in this market. This bill gets us a step closer. It doesn't get us all the way there. And the chair reminded me, like, that's what we do here, Aisha. We do imperfect things that make marginal improvements to situations for people. And so that's what this bill does. And I hope to earn your support.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Gomez. And I'm not sure I said that's all we can do. It's just that,
that's frequently what we end up doing. Maybe.
We try very hard. And thank you for bringing this bill. And we do have three testifiers for the bill. And I see that Representative Munson has his hand up. But if it's okay, Representative Munson, I think I'd like to let the testifiers testify first, and then we will have time to have some discussion. So if that's okay. So first on the agenda is Maren Schroeder. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Liebling, members of the committee, thank you for having me again today. My name is Maren Schroeder, and I'm the policy director for Sensible Change Minnesota, an advocacy nonprofit that has worked extensively with medical cannabis policy since 2015. Our work has expanded the medical cannabis program by adding conditions such as PTSD and chronic pain, and we led the effort for 3 years, thank you, Chair Liebling, to add raw cannabis flower as an allowable delivery method. We thank this committee for always supporting our patient advocacy and appreciate the opportunity to advocate in favor of expanding the medical cannabis market today. I submitted extensive written testimony, and I hope you take the time to review it, but I did want to highlight a few items from that testimony. First, we've seen supply issues with the rollout of flower already. This includes long wait times for pharmacist consultations, significant purchase limits, and we are seeing a rapidly growing patient count that will balloon further with the reduction of the patient registration fee, which will likely exacerbate both of those problems. Number two, patients are still having to drive extended distances to reach patient care centers, as one of our patient testifiers will share. Prices are high and market competition is required to bring them down. One example of this that Representative Gomez alluded to is that Leafline Labs was selling Vireo Health's candy glue flour for $55 at rollout, and Vireo was selling that same product for $75. After that issue was raised, Leafline raised their price on the product to $75 to match Vireo. Bryant, our other testifier, will discuss the need for the market to drive improvements in product, but I would also like to highlight that the variety of product is important for patient efficacy. And finally, even states like Florida, Ohio, and Utah that followed Minnesota's restrictive model did not create duopolies, learning from the issues that we have with our current model. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we look forward to moving this bill through the legislative process.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Schroeder. Bryant Jones, welcome to the committee.
Hello.
Just state your name, if you would, and who you're affiliated with, and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
I'm Bryant Jones, plant scientist and CEO of Charco. Hello, Chair Liebing and members of the committee. I'm a plant scientist who studied proudly at the University of Minnesota. I led cannabis research on multiple projects. Since then, I've become CEO of my own company. It's a horticulture and agricultural research company specializing in the cannabis plant. I also hold three licenses in the state of Massachusetts, one for cultivation, manufacturing, and transportation. I bring this up because I have to travel out of state away from my family and create tax revenue for Massachusetts and not Minnesota. Our state's decision to create a duopoly has lowered the standard for medical cannabis across the board. These companies have no incentive to do better than their competitor. Patients in our state are forced to choose from McDonald's or Burger King for their medicine and have very limited choices, which may not fully address their medical needs. Sound decisions grounded in horticulture are given a backseat to profit-driven objectives in the Minnesotan market. A lack of availability will drive the black market to respond with products and price points appealing to most people. Coming from the University of Minnesota, I was proud to be from a state that leads the world in horticultural decisions, but the way we have chosen to handle medical cannabis is not pioneer and has left many states wondering why we have chosen to create a mafia-style market. I have firsthand experience of outside investors drooling at the opportunity to get in our market, not to serve patients, but to exploit our low standards, lack of social equity, and no beneficial ownership requirements, and ultimately the duopoly. Expanding existing licenses will immediately increase the standards of medical cannabis in the state, diversify the race, and quality will go up, and the opportunity for price fixing will go down. For example, in the state of Massachusetts, there are well over 500 licenses and a very high rate of patient access. Companies can now focus on the genetics and bring quality and increase the consistency of their flower. The Cannabis Control Commission in that state is also creating access for their patients and license holders to cannabis-centered education. In closing, Minnesotans' position to limit the market to only two providers will ultimately stifle and harm our medical cannabis program. I urge the committee to expand that number as fast as possible to create the market that Minnesotans deserve and need. Thank you for your time, Chair Liebling and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. And then lastly, we have Dale, is it Murky? Welcome. And you are muted, sir. There we go.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling, committee members, and guests. My name is Dale Morkey, and I live in Southwest Minnesota in the great city of Luverne. I'm here today to ask you to support this bill, House File 4387, as amended. I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2018. MS is one of the qualifying conditions under the current law. I am not currently at this time a participant in Minnesota's medical cannabis program. Let me explain why. Basically, it is a matter of affordability and accessibility. I've watched the program go through some positive changes since its inception, and I've wondered when it might be worth my time to start the process of getting a medical cannabis certification. To do that, I must have the conversation with my medical providers and then pay them their fee. Then I must pay a fee to the medical cannabis program, which is now $200. Since flower is not available, the hope is that the price will become more affordable, but the availability for purchase during a single dispensary visit is currently severely limited. My next and biggest obstacle will be finding a dispensary that will serve my needs. Currently, the closest dispensary is about 2 hours away in Mankato. A 4 to 5 hour trip for me is a major undertaking. I must take in consideration whether I'm having a good MS day or a bad MS day. Also, in the winter, the weather and road conditions come into play. Right now, I don't see how the current system benefits me or other potential patients in Southwest Minnesota. Our neighbors to the west, South Dakota, are implementing their voter-approved medical cannabis program right now, and in a few months, there will be up to 5 medical dispensaries in Sioux Falls, a mere 35 miles from my home. There are currently 32 dispensaries in South Dakota. The South Dakota medical cannabis program is currently going through rulemaking process to allow out-of-state patients to use their program. I love Minnesota, and I support Minnesota businesses. I also support patients and workers who will benefit from a robust and equitable medical cannabis program. I believe that the current and potential medical cannabis patients will benefit greatly from your support of this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, members, let's go to member questions and discussion. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Gomez, for bringing this bill forward. I support the bill. I think it's great to bring competition into this marketplace to help drive down prices and increase options. As the last testifier alluded to, it's a big issue with the cost. I think one of the things that we're missing on this is that because cannabis is still illegal federally, none of the manufacturers in this business can deduct their cost of goods sold. So they have to pay federal income tax on the entire revenue that they receive. So if they spend $1 million, if they bring in $1 million and they have $800,000 in costs to manufacture that $1 million of marijuana, they have to pay 25% income tax on $1 million. So they're losing money. And that is a frightening thing for any new entrepreneur that's going to start a business. If they can't deduct their cost of goods from their taxes, they're going to be in dire straits, and we're going to have a lot of people broke. But I do like the idea of bringing competition. We need to fix this issue at the federal level so they can fix the federal income taxes. But I do support the bill. I understand it's complicated, but thank you for bringing it forward, and well, hopefully we can get this through.
Thank you, Representative Munson. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And this, I would think, be to the author. My question is would either of the Minnesotans two current manufacturers, would they not be able to meet these new requirements? And then are there any existing manufacturers that could meet these new requirements and so forth? So instead of looking at broadening this, if I'm reading correctly, up to 10, why could we not work with the current manufacturers on this issue?
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Backer. The legislation creates sort of factors for consideration for renewal or expansion of a license or a registration to a new firm. It doesn't list requirements that must be met by the firms. It kind of gives that authority to the commissioner. So as to how, the current firms would fare under, a scheme or an evaluation that took these factors into consideration, I guess it's hard for me to say right now how they would fare. Obviously there's a lot of different things that you think about when they're granting these registrations, including like if they can do the work that they're asking to do. And I would think that the current companies would have, you know, would kind of have a lot to recommend them in that way. And the intent isn't here is not to exclude the current firms from the future of this industry, but it's to introduce, you know, just the possibility of adding firms, or actually, well, it requires that we add two more firms. So the reason that we're not just working with the current firms to meet the need or is because like part of the intent of this bill is that like we just don't believe that we should have such a constricted market. It's not good for consumers. It's not good for our state. And so within, there's no way to satisfy that problem within a statutory duopoly. We have to do away with it.
Representative Backer, anything further?
Yeah, I do appreciate that. I see where the author's going, but I'm going to respectfully disagree that we need to expand this. I see the harm of marijuana. And I know there is a balance. I acknowledge that balance. But I've just Sunday night, I was on the other end of misuse of drugs. Sometimes this wasn't, but there's several times it's prescription drugs. So I just see that we need more work on this. I think what we have right now, yes, Minnesota is one of the most, if not the most restrictive in this country. I think that's wise. I think we have to tread this really carefully because I'm concerned jumping up to 10 is too much. So thank you for my time. I know we have a lot on the agenda, and I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Backer. I definitely, I appreciate the concern about impacts on our communities of substances. But what you were talking about were, you said pharmaceuticals, right? So these are drugs, it's a very different situation. Cannabis is not a pharmaceutical drug. Nobody has ever died from consuming too much cannabis, unlike medications that are very commonly available in most medicine cabinets in our state. So I think that it's really important that we don't conflate cannabis with other substances. Alcohol and tobacco, widely available in all of our communities, kill people. Cannabis doesn't kill people. So, you know, I just, in terms of protecting public safety, that has to be a consideration.
Okay. And members, we are getting kind of off the bill here, which is we're not authorizing medical cannabis for the first time or authorizing personal use cannabis here. The bill is about expanding the market in the medical cannabis space. So, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this would be to the author. A couple of queries. One, if I remember correctly, the original process required a substantial fee, application fee from parties, and would there be a similar fee for any new? And then if anyone did an application for the first time it was introduced, would that be credited for applying to this one? Because there is a lot of people were disappointed at the cost for just a chance. And so I'm trying to understand, the fairness and the process that'd be brought about this time as opposed to the first time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Quam. So I'm not sure about the credit part. You might have to explain what your question is there to me, but just, the application fee is $20,000. It's a lot of money. These new applicants would have to pay that. There is a piece in the bill that we added language that if an applicant's not selected, they get half of that money back. So that's sort of just the general part about the registration fee or application fee, excuse me.
Right. And Representative Quam, follow up?
Yes. The credit is if any entity paid the large application fee and wasn't one of the two selected, is your bill going to charge the same entities an additional application fee, or are they going to say, you've already applied for this in the past, and we're going to waive the application fee?
So if I'm understanding, the question is, are we grandfathering the current firms that have licenses?
No, no, Madam Chair.
In terms of the fee?
More than two entities paid a fee in the first round. If we have this new round and we're collecting a fee, are we going to make people pay a second application fee, or just say you applied first, you paid, and I thought it was more than $20,000 that first time.
I think Representative Gomez got the question now. Representative Gomez.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Quam. Good question. I don't actually know the answer to it, but you're kind of asking us to look back to what happened in 2014 when the original registrations happened. We didn't account for that in the language for the bill, but it's something that we're going to need to talk to the Office of Medical Cannabis about in order to get an answer to your question. But I'm happy to do that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Gomez. All right. Thank you for the good discussion, members. I think with that, I think we are ready to lay over the bill. And so House File 4387, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So thank you very much, Representative Gomez, and testifiers. All right, next up is Representative Hollins, House File 2663. And since she is also not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 2663 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. And I don't think there's an amendment. Am I right, Representative Hollins? So with
you, correct.
Thank you, Representative Hollins, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for hearing this bill. This bill seeks to create a unified and simpler process for changing or removing the sex designation on Minnesota birth certificates. It isn't creating something new. People are allowed to currently change their sex on their birth certificate. We're simply seeking to make the process clearer and with fewer barriers. As you can probably imagine, this is an important process for our trans and non-binary community members. Our birth certificate is a quintessential document that's used for many aspects of our lives. We use our birth certificates to get driver's licenses, gain employment, and get a passport. And having a mismatch between your identity documents really exposes transgender people to discrimination. I have two testifiers here today to discuss the importance of this bill, and I will go ahead and turn it over to them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hollins. So first on my list, we have Phil Duran. Welcome to the committee. And you are muted, so you need to unmute there and tell us who you are and who you represent.
You would think after 2 years. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Phil Duran. I'm with an organization here in St. Paul called Rainbow Health Minnesota. We also have operations in Minneapolis and in Duluth. Our focus is on LGBTQ health, including particular focuses on HIV and aging. At least 47 states in the country have recognized that public policy favors allowing individuals to have correct identity documents, specifically birth certificates. Minnesota for many years has been one of those 47 states, but as Representative Hollins has indicated, the statute that we have that allows for this to move forward is kind of clunky in this particular context. The specific statute is 144.218, particularly reference subdivision 4. At least three specific kinds of questions have been coming up in Minnesota courts that have flummoxed everybody, and so the bill seeks to address all of them. First, the existing statute allows judges to order changes to birth certificates upon a finding that the information on the certificate is incomplete, inaccurate, or false. But some judges have asked the question, well, does that mean that the certificate had to have been incomplete, inaccurate, or false at the time that it was created, which might have been several decades ago? And this is not the kind of change that would be obvious at that time. It almost it would be almost impossible to get a change that way. What this bill does is it simply creates separate language specifically around changing the sex information and just confirms that a person can make such a request. A second kind of question is, well, what does a person need to do or say or bring to a court hearing in order to get a change ordered? Judges have been all over the place on this one. What the bill here does in lines 2.6 through 2.8 is essentially adopts the existing language found in Chapter 259 regarding name changes. This is particularly relevant here because oftentimes these are considered together, a name change and a change of birth certificate. The language specifically comes out of 259.11a, a showing of good faith, a lack of intent to defraud anybody, and in the case of a minor, that it's in the minor's best interest. And then finally, one of the big questions has been, well, what do we do with somebody who currently lives in Minnesota but who was born elsewhere? What can we do here? Again, courts have been all over the place on this. Many courts have issued orders, and then the petitioner takes that order back to their birth state, and they process it from there. But some judges have said, gosh, I don't think I can order Wisconsin to do something. And so what this does is it specifies that, yes, judges do have jurisdiction over such questions, can issue orders of that sort, and that it's really up to the petitioner to then take the ball into the next court and go back to their birth state. This is, in effect, the shoe is on the other foot compared to 144.218 subdivision 5, which is when the reverse is true. When someone born in Minnesota now lives elsewhere, they get a court order from that state, and they bring it back. We recognize it and we process that kind of a request. So this simply confirms that going in the other direction works just as well. And again, the vast majority of states are ready, willing, and able to make the changes necessary. They just need a court order to do it. Finally, the question has been raised many times, is this the sort of thing we truly need to go to court in order to accomplish in the first place? Isn't there a way to work with Minnesota Department of Health to just make these changes on the records that they have control over? And looking at subdivisions 1 and 2 of this bill clarifies that yes, the Department of Health can do so. It sets out examples of the kind of documentation that the Department of Health can use to do this. It's the same kind of process they have right now. There's a form, there's a fee. You send in the documents, they take it from there. And so from our perspective, this would make things a lot easier for petitioners and their families, for attorneys, for courts, for the agencies involved. And we hope the committee will give it its full consideration. And I am done with my comments and turn it over to the next person.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Duran. And we have CB Baga. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself, tell us who you're representing, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. My name is CB Baga. My legal first name is Courtney. I'm an attorney at Fagery, Drinker, Biddle, and Reith. I'm here because I founded the Community Legal Clinic through the Volunteer Lawyers Network, for which we serve LGBTQ clients and particularly focus on helping them navigate identity document corrections and changes. I'm testifying in support of this bill because the current bill has language that's vague and creates uncertainty in both the public and the courts. I've spoken to many judges, I've represented clients in front of many judges, and the general approach is as outlined in the bill that's before you today. The vast majority of judges in Minnesota follow these standards when applying the vague rule. The problem arises when judges are not clear on what the norm is. And in that situation, it takes a lot of back-end conversations among the bench, and then sometimes we have to represent somebody to explain to the judge, like, yes, you can do this, and this is, in fact, standard. And what this bill would do is it would make sure that everybody's on equal footing in understanding what the state of how we approach these issues is. The types of issues that I've seen are things ranging from an applicant appears and the judge says, you know, I just don't know how to interpret this statute, and so I'm just not going to grant this right now. I'll grant part of what you're asking for, but I don't know what to do here. That raises questions down the line as to whether that was denied, and sometimes that can make people feel like they can't actually move forward with following the other approaches, for example, the administrative way to change if there is an order that is unclear from the judge. The other thing that can come in is it just takes a lot of resources for the courts. They prefer to defer to the sorts of things that are listed in the bill here. That is far and away the standard approach. And this would clarify that that is indeed good practice. The result of these clarifications in how the law is currently applied would make sure that identity documents can be used for what they're intended to and be consistent and be things that we can rely on. Where currently, just to give an example, if say a child was born and they're, it was not clear what their medical situation for their sex or gender marker is. Right now, we might not know how to clean that up later when it becomes clear what the appropriate marker to use for that person is. Sometimes there are administrative mistakes. I've worked with clients whose documents were just administratively had the wrong markers or the wrong information, and bringing a court order to a judge and saying, here are this person's documents. They're currently inconsistent. There are everything you can imagine that could go wrong has gone wrong in the system to date. And the clarification that this bill offers will make sure that folks can make sure that their documents are correct and consistent regardless of what has happened before. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I ask that everyone who is considering the bill give it careful consideration and consider voting in favor of it. And I'm happy to take questions, if any.
All right. Thank you very much. That completes our testifiers. So I think we can go to member questions or discussion. So Representative Grinhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I have a question for Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins, you do realize medical experts say you cannot change your sex. So this is anti-biology and anti-science. So the basis of this bill is basically false. Your thoughts?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Grinhagen. I know you and I are in Climate and Energy Committee together as well, and I think we just fundamentally disagree on a lot of the science that we're talking about. This bill isn't about science. It's actually about procedure and procedure for people being able to change a piece of paper. So I don't think that the science, whatever science it is that you believe, really needs to come into it at this point. So I appreciate the comment, but thank you.
Madam
and
Chair.
Representative Grinhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just from my perspective, there's a lot of medical experts that have weighed in, and they say these people need our help to accept their biology, not try to make a change based on feelings. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Grinhagen. I don't know if you heard the testimony, but, it's not only trans people who are impacted by this. I think I heard the testifier say sometimes there's just a mistake on somebody's birth certificate. And sometimes I even know of my own experience that sometimes babies are born intersex and need to be, there's some clarifying surgery or it isn't immediately apparent which gender they are. So there are lots of reasons why you might need to clarify or change what's on a birth certificate. In fact, I understand sometimes they're even left blank on the gender, yep. And there might be one filled in. So anyway, I'm going to go to Representative Backer.
Let me just say, I won't say much back, but I could. But I'm not against changing a mistake, okay? But we're talking about issuing a change of sex on birth certificates, which is medically, biologically, and scientifically impossible. Thank you.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Chair, this may be for the author or one of the testifiers. We on this end of the state, we're real close to Wisconsin, my end, South Dakota. Will other states have to follow this type of Minnesota court orders? What happens if they do or don't? We have a lot of people who travel right now, of course. So how does this affect that, please?
Representative Hollins.
Yeah, thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Backer. I think I'll direct that question to Mr. Duran, who will be able to answer it.
All right, Mr. Duran, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Backer, my experience, and Wisconsin is a great example of that, is most states, well, as I mentioned earlier, 47 states have processes for recognizing a corrected information on birth certificate. And the vast majority of those are happy to process a court order even from another state. And so, for example, we had any number of folks who were born elsewhere, now live in Minnesota, got Minnesota court orders from Goodhue County, for example, comes to mind, and shipped it off to Madison, and Madison had no problem issuing the correct birth certificate from their perspective. So it's pretty straightforward. Is it possible that there is a state that wouldn't accept a court order? Yes, there is. And at which point, then, for example, I consulted on somebody just last week. They're living here today. They were born in Texas, and they got a court order from here in Minnesota, shipped it off to Texas, and Texas said, well, we can't take this because it's got this one thing, this one wording in here. I think the wording actually referred to the Minnesota Department of Health. He said, we can't take it if it's directed to the Minnesota Department of Health. So the individual's going back to the court to just simply correct that, to say, this is for Texas, and then Texas will take it. So standard practice, and I think it reflects exactly your point. People move, and people need to be able to do this. And so the standard practice is we recognize one another's court orders. Minnesota law, as I noted earlier, is already prepared for the opposite situation. This just clarifies that it goes both ways.
Thank you. All right, Representative Backer?
Nothing else. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Representative Hollins, final word on the bill. Oh, I see your testifier wants to make a statement.
Which, I was going to say, yes. Sorry.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Briefly, Representative Liebling. So I have also addressed this issue with a number of clients in courts. And the reality is that most states feel that take the position that they have jurisdiction over the identity of their residents, which makes sense under how we have the law nationally, and each state then gets to decide what the standard is in their own statute, just as we've done here. The problem comes into play when we don't have the ability to tell a client, you know, you should petition in the state that you were born in, because that state statute also says you have to be a resident to move in that court. And so folks are faced with a catch-22 where they can't go home. And so if we don't do it here, then what do we do? But where the jurisdictional line comes into play is that state has passed a statute that sets this forth the standard that has to be met. And so we can take the court order here and bring it to that state, and they decide whether or not it complies with the statute based on the standard in that state. So they get to decide what their own standard is. But then we have jurisdiction in Minnesota over Minnesota's residents for the folks that are here to, you know, process that application in court and provide a court order that is appropriate. So we're not directly trying to assert jurisdiction over the agency, but we are applying a standard to the individual before the court that then the agency gets to accept when they want to, which in this case, most states do want to. They both South Dakota and Wisconsin will accept a court order that has jurisdiction over the person as long as it is the correct type of order. So I hope that clarifies it a little bit into how that jurisdictional line gets drawn. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Final word, Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Chair Liebling, and thank you, committee members, and thank you to my testifiers. There's two things I just want to note in closing. The American Medical Association is actually recommending that we no longer designate sex on birth certificates, specifically for the reasons that you enumerated, that there are a number of individuals, including intersex individuals, that this causes a lot of confusion and disruption in their lives. And so I think that, you know, we are not the first, you know, we're not leading on this, but we're just trying to catch up and make this process a little bit smoother. And then finally, we are still working with the Department of Health to make some technical tweaks to the bill language to make it function more smoothly, but they are aware of this hearing today. So thank you very much, and I appreciate your time today.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Hollins, for bringing the bill. And so with that, and thank you, testifiers, for being here today, House File 2663 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. With that, we will move to House File 2743, Representative Becker Finn, and the chair will move that House File 2743 be re-referred to the General Register. And just to remind members that what we're doing here is taking up some of the licensing or scope of practice bills that we gave a full hearing to, and our intention is to pass them to the floor. So these, if they sound very familiar, they should. So Representative Becker Finn, Chair Becker Finn, thank you for being with us here today. Do you have anything you want to say about your bill?
Thanks, Madam Chair. And just to remind members, this is the bill that would allow therapists to get their licensure hours via technologies like Zoom that we're using right now. It is fully supported by all the boards. And I did want to note that I believe we amended the bill when we initially laid it over. So just that we've got that on the record before we move it forward. It was not engrossed because it was laid over.
Okay. So this would be, thank you for noting that, Representative Becker Finn. It's not in my notes, but so it would be House File 2743 as amended to be re-referred to the General Register. Very good. So with that, thank you. Any questions or comments from members? All right. Seeing none, Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would please take the roll.
Chair Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 18 ayes and zero nays.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. With 18 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you very much, Chair Becker Finn. Okay. We have the next bill on the calendar is House File 2673, Representative Ryer. And Representative Ryer's motion would be that House File 2673 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill, and she has a DE2 amendment, and I assume you would like to move that right away,
Representative Ryer? Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so she is moving the DE2 author's amendment, and let's adopt that, and then she can explain the bill as amended. So all in favor of adoption of the DE2 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Ryer, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here today to talk about House File 2673, a bill related to contracts between dental plans and dental providers. House File 2673 is a transparency bill. It makes basic information available to dentists and patients alike. It's also an empowerment bill that gives dentists decision-making authority over their business practices. This bill does three things. It ensures that fee schedules be provided to dentists so that they can manage their business.
It ensures that they have options for how they wish to receive claims payments from the plan. And it lets them know if the plan they signed a contract with is leasing out the network they're in and ensures that they can opt out if they wish. These are reasonable common sense steps that support dentists in running their businesses and also help avoid confusion for their patients. I'd like to thank all of the interested parties who contributed to this bill. I appreciate the engagement from the Minnesota Dental Association and the dental community, as well as the dental plans and insurers who provided their perspectives. In resolving the final questions they've had, I'm confident that we're delivering legislation that helps Minnesota's dental system work even better for our dentists and their patients. With that, I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers to further explain and speak about the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. So the first is Dr. Amber. Is it Chuck?
I remembered.
Okay. Well, welcome back to the committee, and please go ahead and introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Amber Chuck, and I'm president of the Minnesota Dental Association and a practicing dentist in Litchfield. On behalf of our organization, I thank you for providing me with the opportunity to testify on House File 2673. This legislation addresses three critical aspects of the dentist-dental plan relationship. First and foremost, House File 2673 amends existing Minnesota statutes related to the disclosure of fees by a health plan to a provider. Currently, health plans must provide a full fee schedule in addition to other contract provisions before requiring a provider to sign a contract. However, it's important to note that currently dental plans are noticeably exempt from such a disclosure. This presents an interesting dynamic in that dental providers today are asked to enter into contracts with little or no information on expected reimbursement for services to be rendered under such a contract. No other business transaction would be conceived without the full disclosure of terms, conditions, and fees associated with such a transaction. House File 2673 eliminates this exemption and applies the current contract disclosure statute equally to health plans inclusive of dental plans. A second important provision addresses reimbursement methods such as virtual credit cards that often impose fees in order to collect payment for the service the dentist has provided the patient. Fees associated with these cards range from 2 to 5% and essentially require a provider to pay in order to get paid for the service. Several dentists have reported that some payers afford no other method of receiving reimbursement. And although this practice is not yet widespread in Minnesota, national colleagues are reporting an increase in this very practice. The provision does not prohibit the use of virtual credit cards or any specific mean of reimbursement. It merely provides for full transparency in payment method and, more importantly, affords the provider an option of reimbursement which does not incur fees. It ensures that at least one method be provided that doesn't require a fee for the dentist to access the reimbursement. The third important provision in House File 2673 addresses network leasing, a practice where a dental plan leases its provider network to another entity, which is often an unrelated dental plan. This frequently occurs without any notice to the contracted dentist. The practice results in confusion for both patients and dentists. For the dentist, they may unwillingly be required to comply with the contract terms and payments that may differ from the original contract. Patients may be confronted with a dental practice that has no knowledge of what may be covered by the patient's plan and leads to unnecessary and potential disruptive delivery of care. The bill's language simply ensures the disclosure of a provider network lease arrangement to contracting dentists, including any variations in the contract obligation and fees. It further and most importantly provides the dentist or dental practice an opportunity to opt out of such a leasing agreement without penalty. Madam Chair and member of the committees, I urge you to support this bill and help bring transparency and fairness to the dental plan contracting. Thank you for your hearing this morning. Thank you for hearing this important piece of legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Chuck, and please don't go anywhere. There might be some. So, Joe Lally, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Representative Ryer.
And please state your name and
of course,
representing.
After 20 years, I should know, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Lally. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations at Delta Dental of Minnesota. We wanted to thank a lot of people for putting together this bill, and the amendment reflects a lot of work by a lot of different people. And we want to thank Representative Ryer and House Counsel and our friends at the Minnesota Dental Association for coming to consensus language. There is one small piece, just a few words, in Section 5 of the bill that we have come to agreement with the Dental Association, and have had a chance to visit briefly with Representative Ryer. And it just clarifies what is not a leased arrangement, particularly around the same brand or affiliate. So we're pleased to be able to work collaboratively with everyone, and understand that while an oral amendment is not appropriate today, that amendment will be added at a later date. And again, thank you to everyone involved.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Lally. So that completes the testimony here today. Is there any discussion, questions, or discussion to the bill? All right, not seeing any. It is really nice to see a bill like this where the parties have all reached agreement and everybody feels like it's a step forward. That's really great to see. Thank you for that, Representative Ryer, for your work on this. So final word, Representative Ryer?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just echo the thanks and add that there is one other small piece that will be joining Mr. Lally's in the tweak at the end, and I'm very, very pleased with the outcome here. I think it's good legislation. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So with that, House File 2673 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. The next one that Representative Ryer is bringing us is House File 3839. And that one, the motion is also that the House File 3839 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And Representative Ryer, I don't think there's an amendment on this one. So to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I'm pleased to present House File 3839. This is a bill that modifies a report about Medicaid dental access. As we well know, the state's been looking for solutions to address dental access rates for Minnesotans being served by state public programs to ensure that more Minnesotans see a dentist at least once a year. Last year, we took a big step forward by significantly increasing the reimbursement rate for dentists who treat adult and children enrolled under MA. The intent was to provide the incentives dentists need to see more of these Minnesotans annually. Intent is one thing, but to determine if the rate increase had the desired effect, we also measure. As part of the bill passed last year, DHS was instructed to create a report every March to analyze the impacts of the rate increase on dental access. As currently designed, the report will show dental utilization by enrollees in the PMAP and fee-for-service programs. House File 3839 will add reporting on the number of dentists treating enrollees in these programs in Minnesota Care to see if the number of dentists treating patients in state public programs has increased. This language has been shared with DHS. They've suggested one technical change, revising the timing from coverage year to calendar year, and will make this change while the bill is laid over. I'm happy to take any questions, and we also have a testifier here to assist if needed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. So we don't have anyone who's going to testify just for questions. Okay. Any questions or discussion from members? All right. Not seeing any. Seems like a very good idea to have the number of dentists, and it doesn't seem like it'd be a particularly difficult thing to add either. So thanks for carrying this and bringing that to us. So with that, House File 3839 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So thank you again, Representative Ryer. Okay, We could go on now to House File 2461, Representative Bierman. And Representative Bierman's motion would be that House File 2461 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And there is also an author's amendment. Representative Bierman, did you want to move that first?
Yes, please. Madam Chair, let's move the A1.
All right. The A1 is before us. And so all in favor of adoption of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? All right. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay. Representative Bierman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for that resounding approval of the A1. Appreciate that. Members, as we move ahead working to improve access, quality, and affordability of health for Minnesotans, and to improve the healthcare system, we will need to be innovative. We are moving into an unprecedented time in the world of healthcare and biopharmaceuticals, pivoting from treating the symptoms of rare genetic and life-threatening conditions to actually addressing the underlying cause of disease through gene and cell therapies. This transition is happening because of the incredible innovation taking place at hospitals, research institutions, and biopharmaceutical companies throughout the world, like Mayo Clinic right here in Minnesota. It's an exciting time in the world of medicine, but we must be able to match the innovation happening in research and development with innovation in the world of financing and reimbursement. Our current models for reimbursement are out of date and do not adequately address the changing paradigms. House File 2461 would allow DHS to establish a more sustainable approach to financing and reimbursement for these incredible gene and cell therapies through value-based arrangements. These alternative financing approaches, be it outcomes-based arrangements, payment over time, or something else entirely, will allow DHS to realize the incredible potential for cost offsets over time, but also, and more importantly, create a positive coverage landscape for patients who could benefit most from these innovative therapies. These value-based arrangements will hold manufacturers accountable, tying reimbursement of the therapy to clinical and patient outcomes. Most importantly to me, Madam Chair and members, is that DHS will have the opportunity to design and develop flexible programs and options that reflect the needs of our population. Madam Chair, I would like the committee to hear from a testifier, and then we could go to member questions, please.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. So let's see. I see that we have Lily Melander here. Welcome.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lily Melander, Government Affairs Director for BIO. The Biotechnology Innovation Organization is the world's largest trade association representing biotechnology companies, academic institutions, state biotechnology centers, and related organizations across the United States and in more than 30 other nations. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of Representative Bierman's alternative payment model legislation. BIO and its member companies are committed to ensuring patients have timely access to innovative treatments. BIO strongly supports the states working together with the department and manufacturers on voluntary alternative payment strategies that balance patient care and positive health outcomes against the needs and limitations of the state's finite resources. We believe that alternative payment models have merits to states and biopharmaceutical companies by allowing both parties to share in the risk associated with the cost of innovative therapies. It is imperative to provide a variety of arrangements and flexibility to ensure new models can be developed as healthcare continues to evolve and new therapies come to market. If passed, this bill would continue to ensure Minnesota is at the forefront of medical innovation, being just one of a handful of states that have received clearance from CMS to enter into these value-based arrangements with manufacturers within Medicaid. For these reasons, BIO and its member companies support House File 2461, holding manufacturers accountable for the outcomes of therapies and basing reimbursement on efficacy. in turn enabling Minnesota to provide patients access to groundbreaking, life-saving, and life-changing therapies. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Melander. Appreciate that. So are there questions for members? Comments? So I do have one, for, I guess, for Ms. Melander. So you mentioned that some other states, a few other states have done this. And is it too early to have any outcomes, or how do we get the outcomes? What do the outcomes look like? How will we know? How would we know success if we saw it? That's the question.
Yes, there. Thank you, Chair. There are a handful of states that have entered into these arrangements. Alabama, Arizona, Colorado, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Texas, and Wisconsin. And there are also four states that have passed legislation similar to this, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas. There is actually just a story that Colorado did enter into an agreement with Novartis to treat some for two different drugs, and one of them being SMA. And I know in years past, there was a story that the state paid for this expensive treatment. As we're looking at the future of healthcare, there's going to be more gene therapies coming down the pipeline and entering the market. And these agreements are really going to provide an opportunity for the state to work with the manufacturers, because each state is different, and it provides them the opportunity to create a contract that works within the state staff, the infrastructure capacity, the state budget capacity, and provider readiness. So it's just really allowing each state the opportunity to work closer with the manufacturers. If you've seen one Medicaid department, you've seen one Medicaid department, they're all different. So these are just really working more in lines with the state and the needs of the state.
All right, other questions, members, comments? All right, well, thank you very much. So House Bill 2461 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Okay, we are going to go a little bit out of order here because I understand we have a testifier who might need to leave. And is the testifier still here, Representative Morrison?
Madam Chair, I believe that she is.
Okay, very good. So we will, all right, given that, we will go to House File 4146, Representative Morrison, and the motion there would be that House File 4146 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Representative Morrison, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will try to be brief because, as you can see, our testifier imminently needs to be in the OR. But, Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 4146, which would establish a task force on maternal health and substance use disorder. You may recall that last year we passed bipartisan legislation into law that exempted providers of prenatal care from being mandatory reporters of women who use substances during their pregnancy. This was an important step to removing barriers to care for pregnant women with substance use disorder. Mandatory reporting of controlled substance use causes distrust of providers and avoidance of prenatal care, which leads to worse outcomes for the pregnancy. The changes allowed provider discretion as long as the patient was continuing prenatal care and working with her provider on her care plan. Unfortunately, the changes did not eliminate these complications, and the practice continues in Minnesota or is being implemented in inconsistent ways. Hospitals and health systems have interpreted the changes differently, and there remains confusion for providers of the patient and the baby. The goal of House File 4146 is to develop uniform standards for when a medical professional should or must administer or report the results of a toxicology test for prenatal exposure to a controlled substance, and to discuss and evaluate family-focused substance use disorder treatment models. The task force will include healthcare professionals, practitioners, law enforcement, social workers, county attorneys, substance use disorder providers, and community members with lived experience in this area. The task force will work to streamline guidelines and produce recommendations for our state that can lead to better health outcomes. Seeking prenatal care should not expose a woman to criminal or civil penalties, such as incarceration, involuntary commitment, loss of custody of her children, or loss of housing. People struggling with substance use disorder deserve care, not condemnation. I'm grateful to Senator Julie Rosen for carrying the Senate companion bill, and I hope to earn the full committee's support so that we can improve upon the work we started together. And my testifier, Dr. Elizabeth Allaby, is representing Hennepin Healthcare, is here to testify. So I will turn it over to her. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison and Dr. Allaby. Welcome to the committee. If you would just state your name and who you are, and go ahead and please give us your testimony. And thank you for taking the time.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Allaby, and I've worked at Hennepin Healthcare for 5.5 years as an OBGYN. At Hennepin Healthcare, the majority of pregnant, birthing, and postpartum people are women of color. Our patients distrust the medical system, and the fear of having their child taken away is a significant barrier to care. However, despite this, we see mothers who are trying to do the right thing by getting the care they need for substance use disorder. We spend an entire pregnancy building trust only to have that trust undermined by reporting moms who have been receiving treatment. Prenatal care, education, and supportive programs are some of the biggest determinants of improving outcomes in both mother and child. We also know that families being separated does not improve outcomes. I testified before the legislature last year in support of changes to mandated reporting requirements. We were thrilled when the legislature passed a law to lift these mandated reporting requirements when mothers were actively engaged in care and receiving treatment. At Hennepin Healthcare, we began implementing the change immediately. However, there were challenges. First, even though medical providers no longer had to report moms, social workers and others were still required to report, further undermining the mom's trust in the system. Second, once baby is born, mom and baby are separate patients. If a toxicology test of baby after birth showed any drug use, mom would still be reported, even if she had been following the treatment plan. Third, these nuances created confusion, leading some healthcare systems to proceed as if nothing had changed. It also became clear that some health systems rely on provider discretion in regards to toxicology tests. We know that there are unconscious biases in medicine, which can lead to further disparities regarding who gets tested. So a mom in one health system might get reported to child welfare, but a mom in a different health system might not. The bill before you today creates a task force to look at maternal health and substance use disorder and to establish guidelines on testing and reporting. This task force will truly mean more families staying together, allowing more focus on treatment and prevention. This bill is necessary to address the disparities in reporting to child protection. This is a complex issue with many sectors involved: healthcare, child welfare, addiction medicine, mental health, and more. An issue this complex requires many stakeholders to come to the table with their perspective so we can come to the best solution possible. Thank you, Representative Dr. Morrison, for championing this issue again, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Allaby. Appreciate you taking the time. So, members, questions or comments? Discussion? All right. I do have a question. Maybe it's for Representative Morrison or Dr. Allaby. So, if this task force came up with guidelines, would these be enforceable, or is the plan to come back to the legislature to have, you know, write them into law? Or, you know, how exactly does this help even when you figure out what the standards would be? Could maybe Representative Morrison, that would be for you, I think.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great question. And the bill calls for a report to the legislature, and based on what they find and what the report includes, it may require some legislative changes, but I think that remains to be seen.
Okay, and Dr. Allaby, did you want to add anything to that? Okay, all right, very good. Other questions or comments from members? All right, seeing none, House File 4146 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So thank you very much, Dr. Allaby. Thank you, Representative Morrison. Okay, we will go back then to House File 3416, which is number 9 on our agenda. And Representative Frederick is here. And this one is on the agenda, informational. Representative Frederick, we do have one testifier, but so there's no motion here, but Representative Frederick, the floor is yours to please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. House File 3416 is part of a package of bills looking to address what life is like for a person who has successfully completed substance use disorder treatment. Because essentially right now, once someone successfully completes that treatment, they're just kicked to the curb and says, good luck. And so this looks, the whole package of bills looks to support, to build a support network and help them be as successful as possible. What we know also is people who are suffering from SUD or have gone through treatment, they've also experienced or commonly have experienced a period of homelessness. And with that comes a loss of documentation of state-issued identification, birth record, all of which are needed to gain, to get back into the workforce and help them stand on their own 2 feet. Now, I will say I have met with the Department of Health. And so in the primary bill, House File 3414, this language has their feedback included into it. There was a bit of a miscommunication regarding this particular bill in 3416, in that there was some concerns by the department that we weren't going to go with this current language. And so that and some other issues leading up to the committee where there was a different or wrong bill number that was listed. So we had to work through some of that. So unfortunately, we don't have the amendment to change the language in this bill. I do want to reiterate that I met with the Department of Health again today, and I got assurances from them that the language that is in 3414, which is what our intention to go with, is supported by them. It mimics language that we passed last year after the homeless youth provisions that we focused on to be able to get them identification as well. So I mean, at this point, Madam Chair, I would turn it over to the testifier.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Frederick. So we have Brian, is it Zerbes?
Zerbes.
Zerbes. Okay. Mr. Zerbes, if you would just introduce yourself and tell us who you're representing and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Zerbes. I'm the Vice President of Policy Compliance and Government Relations with North Star Behavioral Health, a substance disorder organization in Minnesota. I'm here representing March as a co-chair of the Government Affairs Committee and speaking to House File 3416. In addition to what Representative Frederick had mentioned, the intention of this bill is to reduce barriers, and it acknowledges that when a person is trying to access treatment, successfully completes treatment, there are many, many barriers, many issues, one of which is trying to reobtain their birth certificate. So what this bill does is it offers a path to do that at no cost to the individual. To echo Representative Frederick's comments, March wants to thank the Minnesota Department of Health for the technical assistance provided, and thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify to this bill.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Zerbes. So questions or comments for members? Okay. And so, Representative Frederick, I wonder if you could just kind of lay out for the committee where the bill is and where it's going so that everybody kind of understands what this little piece is about, because this is the piece that's in our jurisdiction here, but it is a much larger bill, and just so members will know when they see it what it is.
So, Madam Chair, I don't know if you would like to hear this bill again. It's once we can get the amendment and throw that on in this committee. And I'm more than happy to do that. I would imagine at this point after the discussion today, it wouldn't take too much time in the future, if that's your preference. Otherwise, the whole bill is currently sitting in Human Services. It looks at it looks at a person's experience, essentially. After they complete treatment, there is a housing support, there's food support, there's daycare support, there's transportation. There is reimbursement rates for providers addressed in there to try to, you know, create some incentives there because they're having workforce issues just as everyone else in the human services fields. And the list goes on. It's a pretty big package of bills. I think we could spend a lot of time talking about, but I also want to be cognizant of the committee's time here too. So if there's any specific questions, I'm happy to talk about this all day long.
Okay, well, that was very helpful. Thank you. That's kind of what I what I wanted to make sure people understood what we're doing here. And I haven't had a chance to look at that amendment myself, so we may need you to come back and talk about it. But anyway, for now, we appreciate you being here and explaining this to us, and thank you for your work. Thank you, Mr. Zerbas.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So with that, we will move now to House File 4145, which is Representative Morrison's bill. And so let's see if Representative Morrison's back. There she is. And so the motion here would be for 4145 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And there is an author's amendment. Did you want to move that right now, Representative Morrison?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right, so Representative Morrison is moving the A1-A author's amendment. And let's just adopt that, and then you can explain the bill as amended. So all in favor of adoption of the A1-1 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So with that, Representative Morrison, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, House File 4145 is a bill to allow women to receive long-acting reversible contraception, or LARC, such as intrauterine devices or IUDs or subdermal contraceptive implants in an inpatient setting postpartum. Research has demonstrated the beginning of pregnancy within 6 months of a live birth is associated with adverse maternal and neonatal outcomes, like increased risk of premature birth, placental abruption, low birth weight, and maternal anemia. In the United States, an estimated 45% of pregnancies are unintended, and 1/3 of all pregnancies are conceived within 18 months of delivery. Access to contraception in the postpartum period helps reduce unintended pregnancy, improves maternal and neonatal health outcomes, and reduces costs. The immediate postpartum period is a favorable time for LARC insertion. It's convenient for the patient, and many women have the option to get one of these devices placed in the same procedure as their delivery and under the same pain control they may be using for their delivery, rather than having a separate, sometimes painful procedure later in an office setting. After delivery, patients are often motivated to have contraception that doesn't require daily management, anticipating the upcoming busyness of life that a newborn. And while it's usually recommended to wait to resume intercourse until after the 6-week postpartum check, not all women choose to wait, putting them at risk for unintended pregnancy. Providing these devices immediately after childbirth lets women initiate their birth control right away. States that haven't used guidance released by CMS in 2016 that outlined numerous payment approaches that several state Medicaid agencies have used to optimize access and use of LARC. The guidance from CMS in 2016 states that payment challenges related to LARC utilization exist in both fee-for-service and managed care environments. However, most of the states that have worked to provide this coverage generally reimburse hospitals and practitioners the cost of the LARC device outside of the global DRG bundled labor and delivery fee. As a practicing OBGYN myself, I can tell you that LARC methods are among the most effective forms of contraception. LARCs can be safely placed immediately following childbirth prior to hospital discharge. This has obvious advantages for patients who want this form of contraception. LARC device and placement procedures are a covered benefit by private insurers, but generally in an outpatient setting. That typically means that a patient could come back for her 6-week postpartum appointment or sooner, and the cost of the device and placement would be covered. And that works for some people. Others would prefer to have a LARC placed immediately postpartum. It tends to be less painful to insert as the cervix is already dilated. Some patients have an epidural that provides further pain relief. Having it placed while they're still in the hospital provides peace of mind for some patients and should be an option for those who would like it. The bundled labor and delivery payment that hospitals receive at the time of delivery include the delivery and immediate postpartum services for a vaginal birth. The bundled payment is adjusted for additional services or pay. For example, a postpartum tubal ligation procedure is separate from the bundled labor and delivery package. This bill would ensure that the insertion of a LARC postpartum would also be an additional service beyond the delivery. The device cost insertion should include an additional payment. And members, you should have received the CMS guidance to states with a table on how the 42 other states have dealt with this issue. Most states have allowed hospitals to bill for the cost of the device outside of the DRG. IUD insertion is a covered benefit, and it shouldn't matter if a patient receives it immediately postpartum or as an inpatient or as an outpatient. I appreciate the dialogue that we've had with DHS regarding this issue, and I'm hopeful that we can land on a solution to improve access for patients. Madam Chair, I do have a testifier representing the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Dr. Lisa Mattson.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. Dr. Mattson, welcome to the committee. Please just give us your name and who you represent, and please go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Lisa Mattson, and I am also an OBGYN, speaking on behalf of the American College of OBGYNs in support of House File 4145. Access to birth control, as we all know, is a covered benefit for all women under the Accountable Care Act, and it allows women to obtain birth control at any time in her life, including the postpartum period. Immediate postpartum long-acting reversible contraception refers to the insertion of an intrauterine device or contraceptive implant immediately after childbirth and before hospital discharge, as Dr. Morrison just stated. This service is supported by national guidelines as being best practice and can also circumvent potential barriers women face in obtaining postpartum birth control by eliminating the need for additional transportation, finding childcare, or getting time off work 6 weeks later. In Minnesota, hospitals receive a bundled payment for each delivery that is performed, and LARCs are currently included in this payment. This single bundled payment does not sufficiently address the costs associated with the insertion of LARCs and ultimately disincentivizes hospitals from even stocking these devices. It is not clear why the elective insertion of a LARC device is included in this payment when an elective postpartum tubal ligation is reimbursed outside of the bundled payment. House File 4145 is simply asking that the insertion of LARCs be paid for separately in the same way they are paid for when we do them at any other time in a woman's life, and that the hospital is reimbursed for the cost of each device so they can afford to have them in stock and readily available for use by women who desire this form of birth control. Minnesotans pride ourselves in the ability of the healthcare in the quality of the health care that we provide and we receive in our state. And we would like to continue to live up to this reputation and our goal of being the healthiest state in the nation by passing House File 4145. Thank you for your attention to this important health issue. I'm more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mattson. We appreciate your testimony. Members, are there any questions or discussion? All right. Okay. Representative Bonner.
Sorry, I wasn't quite fast enough. I just want to thank Representative Morrison again for bringing this forward. You know, I will tell you, I am the very proud aunt of a 7-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 5-year-old. And part of the reason for that timing is, of course, because my sweet niece, after the first one, she asked for this procedure to be done. To have a little more space in between those little sweet children, and was not able to get that procedure in the hospital as she requested. And lo and behold, guess what? Along came baby number 2, and surprise, surprise, then followed by baby number 3. So I think this is one of those situations in which I know that mothers are asking for this. I know that they want the ability to have this done within the hospital setting. And so I'm really grateful for this bill. I think it's a good bill. And I know that there are a lot of moms out there who love their children, but would very much like the freedom to have a little bit more breathing room in between each one. So thank you, Dr. Morrison, and thank you, Dr. Mattson.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Other discussion? All right, Representative Morrison, final word on the bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for your consideration of House File 4145. This bill is pretty straightforward. It calls for separate reimbursement to hospitals for LARC provided immediately postpartum in the inpatient hospital setting. This is a health equity issue, a public health issue, and an access issue. Please support this effort to support women's and infants' health.
All right. Thank you very much. So House File 4145, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. Okay. So members, it is 4:45, and we had contemplated possibly taking a break at 4:45, but we are really moving right along, and House Information has kindly told us that it's okay if we don't take a break. So I think that we are moving along so well that maybe we'll just forgo the break, and I think we can be done pretty expeditiously. So that's what I think we will do, and I hope that's okay with everybody. So the next bill on the agenda then is another Representative Morrison bill, and that would be House File 2768. And the motion here would be that House File 2768 be re-referred to the General Register. And as members may recall, this is a bill that we heard testimony on previously. And Representative Morrison, if you would just remind us of what it is and what it does, and then, and of course, if there's any amendment needed, please let us know. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I will be brief, because this bill has already been before you. House File 2768 is a bill that will allow pharmacists to administer subcutaneous and intramuscular injections with a prescription and allow them to help patients with external health monitoring devices. That's it. I can say more if you'd like, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's see if there are any questions or discussion from members. Questions or discussion? Not seeing any, so I think we're good. I see that Dr. Weiberg is here. He's not scheduled to testify, but he's just here for questions, I think. And so with that, Representative Morrison will renew her motion that House File 2768 be re-referred to the General Register. And Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would please take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grünhagen.
Grünhagen, aye.
Grünhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Yes.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 19 ayes and 0 nays.
Right. There being 19 ayes and 0 nays, House File 2768 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Morrison. Okay. Next bill on the agenda is House File 1888, Representative Hewitt. And this, again, is a bill that we heard, although I think we need to do some amending, and the intention here, the motion, will be that House File 1888, make sure I got enough, the right number of eights there, 888, will be amended and will be re-referred to Ways and Means. So, Representative Hewitt, the bill is before us, and there is a DE2 author's amendment, and maybe before we adopt that, Representative Hewitt, maybe we should discuss that just a little bit, because I think it does significantly change the bill and the result of some work that you did. And maybe we could have a little discussion before we amend it. So, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to members to listen to this. I'm hoping this is the last discussion we have on this topic, because I'm pretty much burnt on it too. So anyways, I'd like to thank Representative Schumacher. Basically what we've done with the amendment is we put some guardrails into my bill, taking his bill and making this bill the best bill. And so we have peace in the universe with this. What it did is it took out much of the scope that I had in and put in his, so we could, he has a removal technician basically. It requires training, it requires continuing ads, it requires supervision basically by a funeral director. This made this bill much stronger and much better and definitely agreed upon by the funeral directors, as you can see a support letter. Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would just recommend voting for the amendment here. As Representative Hewitt mentioned, there's some new guardrails in this amendment that make it a stronger bill. When I was talking to my funeral directors about this bill, they had their concerns about just how far people could go without having to be registered or having any penalties for how they operated there. And so this gives it the teeth that we need to have to make this work for everyone. So I recommend a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. So the author's amendment, the DE2, is before us. Is there any other discussion to the DE2 amendment that we've been discussing here? All right, seeing none, so Representative Hewitt is moving the DE2 amendment. All in favor of the DE2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the DE2 amendment is adopted. And then we will vote the bill. So the Representative Hewitt is going to renew his motion that House File 1888 as amended be re-referred to Ways and Means. And before we take the vote, I just would like to say that I'm really grateful to Representative Hewitt and Representative Schumacher. And this is the way we should be working. This is a really nice outcome. It is going to help, I think, with some workforce shortage in the funeral industry, and as Representative Hewitt said, put some guardrails around it to make sure that services are delivered by people who are qualified and well-supervised and so on. So really appreciate everyone's work here. And with that, Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would call the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Yes.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 19 ayes and 0 nays.
Great. There being 19 ayes and 0 nays, House File 1888 as amended is re-referred to Ways and Means. Thank you. Okay, next on the agenda, we have House File 3989, Representative Bonner, and Representative Bonner moves that House File 3989 be re-referred to the General Register, and there is an author's amendment. Representative Bonner, I assume you want to move that right away and explain it?
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, I want to thank the chair actually and staff for actually catching this error. In reviewing the language, we had a number of legal professionals that reviewed all of the language to update this bill. It is a technical bill for the most part, but there was one reference where we actually struck some language that should not have been stricken. So this reinstates that language to provide an exception to the PA scope of practice. And then it makes one additional minor change in more for clarity in defining the scope very clearly. So that is the change. And so with that, I would appreciate if we could support the A5 amendment.
Okay. And Representative Bonner, I have that it's the A3 amendment.
Oh,
is
no.
That correct?
I'm sorry. A3, my apologies. I've had three bills up today.
Okay. All right. So it's the A3 author's amendment. So any discussion to the A3? All right. Seeing none, all in favor of the A3 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 And any opposed? All right. The A3, the motion prevails and the A3 is adopted. And anything further on the bill, Representative Bonner?
Sure, I can briefly just recover what the bill is about. Back in 2020, Chair Schultz carried a bill co-authored by many of the folks on this committee, which updated the Practice Act for physician assistants. This bill does not actually change any of that scope, but just merely updates references within the statute that refer to physician assistants. It also updates four references to APRNs that were missed when they did their cleanup bill, so adds that in. And it also, lastly, it updates two PA references and clarifies something that was caught by NAMI. For greater accuracy and clarity. The bill is supported by the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants and the APR Coalition, as well as MMA, the Board of Medicine, the Board of Pharmacy, and NAMI.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And just, you know, to be really clear, I guess the thing I always, my heart always skips a little bit when you say it's mainly a technical bill. Because, you know, I think the intention here, if I'm correct, and just confirm for me, please, the intention is it's not changing anybody's scope of practice. Is that right?
That is correct, Madam Chair. It is intended only to update references and not to change any of the
All right.
scope of practice.
All right. Thank you. And of course, the concern is it's a very long bill with a lot of these little changes, and that's why it gives me just a bit of heartburn because, you know, there's just a lot in here. It's easy to make a mistake, but I think we've got it now. So, okay. And so Representative Bonner is going to renew her motion that House File 3989 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. So with that, Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would please take the roll and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Yes.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, yes. Aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 19 ayes and 0 nays.
All right. There being 19 ayes and 0 nays, House File 3989, as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. And then finally, we have House File 3099. Representative Bennett, welcome back. And the chair will move that House File 3099 be re-referred to the General Register. Again, this is a bill that we heard already, and I don't think there are any amendments. And Representative Bennett, if you would just briefly remind us what the bill is, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to briefly go over this, this bill simply changes the date for podiatric preceptorships. That's kind of a tongue twister. From Minnesota's current date of 1986 to 1990. And this is just to help podiatrists who are nearing retirement, who may want to come and practice medicine in Minnesota, for example, from Iowa, whose date, their cutoff date is 1993. Those people could come practice in Minnesota as well. We do have one podiatrist who's waiting and chomping at the bit to get here and work in Albert Lea. So I won't say anything more. I hopefully have reminded you what it is and would love to see you all send this on further.
Thank you very much, Representative Bennett. Are there any questions or discussion to the bill? All right, seeing none, so I will renew my motion that House File 3099 be re-referred to the General Register. And if Ms. Niedernhofer would call the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Yes.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
And I will go back and check and see if Representative Bierman is here. Okay. There are 18 ayes and 0 nays.
Right. There being 18 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails and House File 3099 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Bennett. Okay, members, we have gotten through the agenda. We saved ourselves an hour, so I really appreciate everybody's hard work today and look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Right? Tomorrow is Wednesday, so we'll be back at it. So with that, members, thank you very much. We are adjourned.